At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
We got cars on the program today. We got coal and we got scooters. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Wednesday, the 5th of December today. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin on this Wednesday with some energy news, the subtext of which is the market is going to do what the market wants to do. We are talking coal specifically here, and some new numbers from the U.S. Energy Information Administration showing coal consumption in this economy is on track to hit a near 40-year low. That's despite President Trump's winning campaign promise to save the American coal industry by rolling back environmental regulations and therefore making it easier for mines and power plants to do business. There are some new rules and updates coming out from the Environmental Protection Administration this week. We are told to continue on that deregulatory path. But as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, that may not be enough to change the energy economy's mind.
Coal is still a major source of energy in the United States, but coal consumption dropped about 4% in the last year. That decline is likely to continue. Leah Stokes studies the energy sector as an assistant professor at UC Santa Barbara.
Cheaper alternatives and competitive natural gas, as well as, you know, making coal more expensive through environmental regulations, has really led to a drop in coal.
Stokes says even if new EPA rules ease the restrictions on coal power plants, many of them have already shut down and more closures are planned. It's unlikely to make economic sense to restart shuttered plants, but
if environmental regulations are weakened, you could imagine that some of these plants at the margin might be a little more competitive.
The National Mining Association declined comment, and the American Coal Council didn't have anyone available to talk today about the latest energy report. For the industry, there are more challenges than cheap natural gas and regulatory hurdles. New technologies are increasing energy efficiency and making wind and solar more competitive. Seth Feaster is with the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis.
The economics in this at the present time are so powerful that the transformation is happening in this industry regardless of what the policies are coming out of Washington.
But new policies may still give the coal industry a bit of a reprieve. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Here's another one where government policy goes toe-to-toe with market forces. President Trump, as you might have heard, met with German carmakers at the White House yesterday, BMW, Daimler, and Volkswagen to be specific, trying to convince them to make more of their cars here. The context is the very public mulling that the president has been doing about maybe slapping new tariffs on those auto imports. And the readout of the meeting was some squishy positive comments about how those companies might be investing more in the United States, but also suggesting that new tariffs would put the kibosh on the whole thing. So Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson looked at the political versus the economic motivations for those foreign automakers to build more of what they build right here.
These days, companies recognize the value of keeping politicians happy.
It's interesting that the foreign CEOs seem to be playing along with Trump.
Dan Eikenson with the Cato Institute says it's unclear whether that's just talk or if foreign automakers can be pressured into significant new investments in the U.S. In the 1980s, U.S. trade protections did encourage Japanese automakers to build more of their cars here.
And so there's this view that that will work. But the fact is that today, you know, global supply chains are much more diversified, much more internationalized.
BMW exports 70% of the cars it makes in its South Carolina plant. The top destination, China. So ongoing trade disputes are adding lots of uncertainty for automakers about the tariffs their cars will face as they move across borders. Also, whether they'll have to pay tariffs on the car parts they need to import. Emily Blanchard is a professor at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business.
For foreign automakers, they tend to, not always, but they tend to use a whole lot more inputs and supplies from producers back in the home country.
Because these investments take lots of time and money, the industry needs to know the rules of the game before they place their bets, says Michelle Krebs, an auto analyst at AutoTrader. But also,
we're on the verge of some major change in the industry, going to electric vehicles and autonomous vehicles, and nobody knows exactly when that will gain traction.
She says it's not just trade that complicates these investment decisions. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, nothing doing, actually, to mark President Bush's funeral. Some Bush-era market context, though, when we do the numbers. In a way, it's a good thing for CBS that the markets weren't open today, because the latest New York Times revelations about what the company's former CEO Les Moonves did and what the company's board of directors knew about what Moonves did to cover up allegations of sexual misconduct would have only added to the company's Wall Street woes of late. The Times is reporting that Moonves misled investigators and destroyed evidence to protect his $120 million severance package, and that at least one board member knew about an allegation of sexual misconduct by Moonves years before it came to light. There are at least two ways to look at this, right? What a board and its members should do when they come upon material information, and what the law requires it to do. Marketplace's Amy Scott has that one.
What are board members supposed to do when they learn about something that could end up hurting the bottom line? From an ethical standpoint, the answer is pretty simple. Charles Elson is director of the Weinberg Center for Corporate Governance at the University of Delaware. He says,
now, the director has information that's vital to the appropriate oversight of management and doesn't come forward with it to the board, that's a real problem.
But from a legal perspective, the obligations are less clear.
This is a very gray area.
Michelle Lowry is with the Corporate Governance Institute at Drexel University. She says board members have what's called a fiduciary duty to do what's best for their shareholders. But that leaves a lot of room for judgment. In a very different example, when Steve Jobs got sick, the board at Apple had to decide how much to disclose.
How do you weigh sort of privacy versus right to know versus shareholder value?
Experts say it comes down to what's called materiality, essentially the significance of the problem or behavior in question to the health of the company. And Lowry says when you're talking about potentially criminal acts,
it seems pretty clear that they have an obligation to share that information and to decide how to act on it. I mean, if we look at what's happening to CBS now, I think there's no question that this is having negative effects on the company.
Not only on its reputation and workplace morale, but its share price, which is down about 10% since the allegations against Moonves became public. Peter Havilis is a partner at law firm Pepper Hamilton. He says as to legal liability,
I'll let the courts in Delaware decide, because there's litigation going on by shareholders already.
A few years ago, the Harvard Business Review looked at the consequences of bad behavior by CEOs. In a third of cases, the company faced some kind of fallout, losing clients, proxy battles, or shareholder lawsuits. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
We're going to take the energy news from coal to oil. Now, OPEC meets tomorrow. It is, as most of the cartel's gatherings are, one that's going to have people watching pretty closely to see whether there's going to be a production cut as promised, and so, in theory, drive prices higher. The actual watching of that meeting, though, is what we're going to talk about. The OPEC chatter, rumor, and innuendo that usually happens, as you're about to hear, in a stairwell in the OPEC building in Vienna, Austria. Marketplace's Scott Tong takes us there, kinda.
We're not actually in Vienna, but we got three oil market geeks into our office stairwell in D.C. to opine on the OPEC building stairwell and why it matters.
Leslie Hayward, Vice President at Securing America's Future Energy.
Bob McNally, President and Founder of Rapidan Energy Group.
Jamie Webster, a fellow at Columbia's Center on Global Energy Policy.
Hayward, a journalist, explains that at OPEC meetings, the reporters and analysts normally gather in a holding pen of sorts, a stairwell outside the big meeting, and they hold for hours.
In the stairwell, you are joined by about 200 of your competitors, and you are waiting to get the best position possible.
Think Black Friday, waiting for Walmart to open.
There's a velvet rope type thing, and everybody lines up behind it and prepares
for the OPEC stampede into the conference room to interview the powerful oil barons. Now, to analyst Bob McNally, the period in the stairwell just before this is critical.
Think of the stairwell moment as the peak moment of anticipation. These journalists have been chasing down the ministers when they arrived at the Vienna airport. They've been going to the preliminary meetings. By the time we're in the stairwell, you're at that moment of peak frenzy.
Frenzy, because oil and oil prices matter. Prices too high have triggered recessions, even wars. Too low, and petrostates have collapsed. Prices have swung wildly this past decade, meaning more drama and more bodies in the OPEC stairwell. Analyst Jamie Webster says there, everyone is on their phones as they wait. Some are tweeting rumors, and others are peeking at their neighbors' phones.
I've heard of people peeking at screens. Obviously, I'm sure none of us have ever done that.
But peekers beware. Delegations have been known to peddle false rumors to analysts, say that OPEC is going to cut production.
You might tell Bob and I, oh, a cut's definitely going to happen. We say it, then people start to believe, oh, this is actually going to happen. And then other delegations might be like, well, we got to get on board with this.
2 years ago in Vienna, Leslie Hayward had the perfect spot in the stairwell.
I was in the pole position next to the Wall Street Journal and the Financial Times.
When suddenly the sprint began and a Cinderella moment, Hayward lost her shoe.
I remember it coming off my foot, and I remember thinking, I'm not going back for that, and just kept going, and I did get my spot. I live-tweeted the entire commentary from the minister. At the end, I looked down, and I only had one shoe on.
Later, they returned her slipper, actually her flat, and it was all documented on the stairwell's Twitter account. That's right, at OPEC Stairwell spins bad oil market puns, even a poem that begins, "Two stairwells diverged." But to be serious, tomorrow's intrigue at OPEC will be intense. The group may raise prices by cutting supply, but there are two wild cards outside OPEC. One is President Trump pressuring Saudi Arabia. Bob McNally.
The Saudis are very concerned about their core relationship with the United States for obvious reasons, not the least of which have to do with the Khashoggi affair. And the president's made it very clear he wants oil prices to go low.
So what will the Saudis do? What will the Russians do? They're not in OPEC, but have lately joined forces with the group to give it even more market power. The Russians will join the so-called OPEC Plus meetings on the second day. The pros in our stairwell, they may already know what'll happen, though they don't divulge their sources. Because what happens in the OPEC stairwell, you know. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Like, oh, that's for tourists. That's for folks, you know, who aren't from here.
Transit for locals. But first, let's do the numbers. As I said, American markets, stocks, and bonds were closed today to honor President Bush. But on his last day in office, January the 20th, 1993, the Dow Industrials closed at 3,242. That was a gain of 45% from the time he took office 4 years earlier. The S&P 500 had picked up 51% in the Bush 41 years, 433 when he left office. The NASDAQ soared 78%, 697 to close on the last day of his term. Global markets, though, they were open today. Britain's FTSE lost 1.4%. The French CAC 40 fell 1.3%. And you're listening to Marketplace. Listeners like you who give to Marketplace do more than just keep us on the air. You make it possible for us to grow and get better. It's a way to directly support independent reporting and journalism that you trust and to help us make people smarter about the economy and how it affects our lives. And when you give today, the impact of your gift will be doubled thanks to our friends at Candida. So please donate now at marketplace.org to make your donation go twice as far. And thanks.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. There are some conveniences in this modern life that maybe, yes, we have come to take for granted. Being able to look up basically anything on the internet, for one thing. Jobs are where this program and that idea intersect, where the best places to work are, and more importantly, actually, what the salary for some of those jobs is. That kind of thing's really only been available online for a decade or so, thanks to a company called Glassdoor, one of the world's biggest job and recruiting sites. Robert Homan is the CEO. He's also a co-founder. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Kai.
So 10 years ago, you've been through Microsoft, you've been through Hotwire, Expedia, all those companies, and you decided to do this. Why?
Well, it was because we thought that where you go to work is probably one of the most important decisions that you make in your life. And how much you get paid for it really matters to, you know, most people. And before Glassdoor, maybe you were lucky enough to know one person you could ask what it was like to work at a company you were interviewing at, but like that's a sample of one. And we felt like, man, if we could build a safe place where everyone could talk about what's great about their workplaces and what needs work, and also tell people how much they make, that would be an incredible resource to job seekers trying to figure out where to go to work. And that's how Glassdoor was born.
What was it about salary, right? Why is that the nugget there?
Well, in 2007, when we started building this, you have to remember there was really poor information on what fair salary was. I remember when I started at Microsoft, I had no idea what fair pay was for my role. You know, and this has been a pattern in companies that I've worked at is in that negotiation, the employer has all the power because they have all the information around what they pay. And you, the job seeker, have almost no power. Glassdoor was about leveling that information asymmetry.
This skips down a little bit in my list of questions, but it seems like given where we are now with transparency on a lot of things, not just salary, but cultural norms inside a workplace and sexual harassment inside a workplace and all that. It seems you got your timing pretty right. I mean, you had a little head start. You started with salary, and now you're at a place where transparency is a value and a virtue that people are looking for in employment.
You know, I think it's a wave that has been 20 years building that maybe is cresting now. The internet and the democratization of information, I really do think, is this inexorable force. And that's a great thing. And it's a challenging thing, I think, for society, too, as you know, we're going through right now. Mm-hmm. But it's one that I think helps people ultimately live better lives and make better decisions.
This is a little sideways, but is a tight labor market good for you business-wise? Must be, right?
Let me think about that.
Well, more people out there hustling, trying to find a job when jobs are, right? You know.
Yeah. I mean, generally speaking, tight labor markets are good for recruiting services, for sure. It's hard being a company actually trying to hire
this market. So double-edged sword. Yeah.
Because, man, it's crazy. So hard.
Well, tell me more about that. I mean, you're in, you know, Silicon Valley adjacent, as it were, up in North Bay. I mean, is it still tough for you to find people up there?
Oh, the Bay Area is just absolutely bananas. We have, you know, nearly every job available in the country, so we can see that we're at a record high number of unfilled jobs at about 7 million right now. So, you know, the economy is running super, super hot. And yeah, as a tech company trying to hire into that market, it's just absolutely crazy. And salaries just march up month after month. At some point, it's going to be unsustainable.
Well, let me go further down that road with you there, Mr. Recruiting and Job Services Company guy. What's it going to look like when finally companies realize that they're going to have to raise wages and hire more people?
Yeah, I think that wage raising we're definitely seeing in tech already. That has to inevitably, I think, come and probably be translated to inflation. Huh. And as, you know, has been talked much about, we are way overdue for a recession. the question we don't know is, will it be a deep recession or a soft recession, and how long will it last, and all those good things.
A word here about you. Do you still write code for this platform? I read somewhere that you still go home at night and still code.
It's funny you asked that. So I am a software engineer originally, and I worked on the first Glassdoor. I am back to writing code.
he says proudly.
People ask me, and I got scolded for it, you know, as a CEO over the years, because, you know, they'd say, we need a CEO, not another software engineer. But you know what I've discovered? It's sort of like my painting. You know, it's just like, I need a creative outlet. Yeah. And that's what coding is for me. Keeps me sane.
Robert Homan, he's one of the co-founders, also the CEO of Glassdoor. Robert, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thanks, Kai.
Not at all coincidentally, Glassdoor released its annual list of the best companies to work for this morning. Number one, Bain and Company, the consulting firm. It beat out Facebook, which had the top spot last year. You can check out the full list at marketplace.org. A lot of cities around the country are trying to figure out something that transportation planners call the last mile problem. How do you get people who don't drive across that last mile from the nearest transit stop to wherever they want to get faster than them walking? It's a particular problem in low-income neighborhoods where a lot of people don't own cars and transit can be spotty. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino looked into how the sharing economy and how it's growing might help solve that problem. Think two-wheeled options.
For years, Eric Huerta and his Los Angeles group, People for Mobility Justice, have been big fans of bikes.
As like viable alternatives to having a car and maintenance and all that comes with it.
He's worked to expand access to public bike share with discount programs and community outreach, but he's starting to realize traditional docked bikes can only go so far.
It's a whole process, right? They have to remove a parking space. They have to install the system where you have to check it out and the bikes and all this other stuff. Seeing where the bikes are being placed, it's super obvious that these are like touristy locations.
In his mostly Latino neighborhood of East LA, there are no bike share stations. But lately, here and there, he has been seeing electric scooters, the zippy little devices that have practically taken over wealthy neighborhoods at the beach more than a dozen miles away.
And I would just think, wow, I guess somebody really took it all the way out here.
Huerta and his neighbors regard the scooters with a kind of wary curiosity, like escaped zoo animals that might be dangerous.
You associate it with like tech bros, like, oh, that's for tourists, that's for folks, you know, who aren't from here.
In well-heeled communities, scooters have riled people up because they can be picked up and dropped off pretty much anywhere, including the middle of the sidewalk. But Regina Clulow, the CEO of Populous, a data platform that works with cities and scooter companies to analyze how they're being used, says that also makes them surprisingly egalitarian.
We are finding that newer services, such as dockless bikes and scooters, are being adopted at higher rates by traditionally underserved communities.
Clulow found that in Washington, D.C., dockless devices like scooters were spread more evenly throughout low-income neighborhoods, and that Black residents were almost three times more likely to try them than the docked Capital bike share system. Like many cities, D.C. is making policies to promote dockless transportation in low-income areas. For example, you can check out a scooter using preloaded cash instead of a credit card. Los Angeles has capped the number of scooters in most areas, but allows more in disadvantaged neighborhoods, and several cities require discounted rates for people on public assistance. The scooters typically cost $1 to unlock and 15 cents per minute. Lime cuts that in half and Bird waives the $1 fee. But forcing private companies to serve the public good is a delicate balancing act, says Susan Shaheen, a professor at UC Berkeley who studies emerging transportation tech.
It's going to be important that the companies aren't so encumbered that they're unable to start inching towards profitability, because then they may be forced to leave altogether.
That's what the Chinese bike company Ofo did. It was one of the early entrants into the dockless market, but it pulled out of 30 U.S. cities over the summer because it said local regulations were undercutting its business model. Shaheen says another big obstacle for scooters is how they may be perceived.
The image of that or the relationship of that to tech could also be a limiting factor in its appeal to low-income neighborhoods.
That's the case for transportation activist Eric Huerta and the people in the communities where he works. As those neighborhoods gentrify, it's almost like scooters are a physical manifestation of the forces that threaten them.
We've kind of been left out in the cold for so long. So when you see these kind of new services come in, it's healthy to be, you know, hesitant about, well, is this for me?
But he's cautiously optimistic. Scooter companies have reached out to him for input, and he's willing to give them a chance.
Like, I really want to try this out for myself and see what it's all about, just to get a better understanding of whether this is something that I would take seriously as a mode of transportation.
And that underserved neighborhoods can depend on scooters to help solve the last mile problem. Or whether they'll end up just another tech fad that burns out like yesterday's hoverboards. In Los Angeles, I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a very small slice of President Bush's funeral from this morning that seems to fit. It's Bush 43, obviously, doing the talking here.
In his inaugural address, the 41st President of the United States said this: "We cannot hope only to leave our children a bigger car, a bigger bank account. We must hope to give them a sense of what it means to be a loyal friend, a loving parent, a citizen who leaves his home, his neighborhood, and town better than he found it. What do we want the men and women who work with us to say when we are no longer there? That we were more driven to succeed than anyone around us, or that we stopped to ask if a sick child had gotten better and stayed a moment there to trade a word of friendship."
All right, we got to go. As I said, Wall Street closed today for President Bush's funeral. The global markets, though, were working, and they were down. Europe was down. Hong Kong was down. Shanghai Composite was down. American markets back in business tomorrow. Sarah Bergere, Jake Gorski, Drew Josta, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the program for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.